Hey everyone, it's George Edelman, editor-in-chief at No Film School. Today we have another exciting interview for you with an editor of one of the top movies this year. Whatever you write, whatever you shoot, whatever you're planning your story to be, it can all change in the edit room. We know that editing is a hugely important part of the process. The story gets built, crafted, rebuilt, re-understood, and found in many ways. And it's been great having editors come on the No Film School podcast and tell us about how they built their careers, how they find the stories they're working on, and how they work with the directors and the writers and the filmmakers that they're collaborating with. And today, we have the editor of the awards darling, The Power of the Dog, Peter Siberis. Peter has been cutting feature films and shorts for a long time. He did a couple other big ones, War Machine, The King, and a few series. He tells us how he got the gig on The Power of the Dog, how Jane Campion knew about him, how they met and he won her over the room, and they connected on what the story could be. But we really talk about editing The Power of the Dog. This is a movie that's all about tension and pacing and careful construction of plot points. And one of the cool things about talking to Peter is that there was so much done intentionally. It wasn't the kind of thing where they were just, you know, let's try to find the beats that tell the story scene to scene. No knock on that. That's how you keep an audience engaged. And that's so much of what an editor and a filmmaker does. But in the case of Power of the Dog, they were really going for bigger things. They wanted the audience to put pieces together. They wanted them to see subtext. They wanted them to feel and think about things that weren't necessarily obvious. And there's this kind of dance between what they're letting you know and what they're keeping from you and what you're supposed to deduce and how you're supposed to realize things. And that's pretty surgical when you think about it. And of course, we talk a lot about Bronco Henry. If you haven't seen Power of the Dog, check it out. If you have seen it, you're going to love this interview. I would recommend that you watch it before you check out this interview just because we really get into the weeds on it. And I would normally have avoided doing something like that. But this is a movie that's nominated for many Oscars, including Best Editor for Peter. So definitely give it a look and then come back here and use this sort of as your commentary track. Like special features on a DVD. Remember those? Anyway, here we go. And here's Peter on Power of the Dog and Bronco Henry. Thank you so much for doing this. We've been waiting to get together for a while, and I'm really excited to finally talk to you. You know, the film has been celebrated a lot already. It's had a really big impact. People love it. And there's a lot there to talk about. But before we get into The Power of the Dog, I just wanted to talk a little bit about your career. What got you started and what was sort of your foot in the door and got you onto this track and into this part of the industry?
Yeah, it's a good question. I started cutting when I was in my mid-20s. I was kind of cutting some music videos for a housemate and just really loved it. At the time, I was kind of searching. I'd studied illustration and been trying a bunch of stuff. And when I finally, I'd always thought about editing, but I didn't know any editors really or anything. So I just kind of tried it when my housemate started making music videos and really loved it. And then from there, I quickly just found a friend of a friend was a great commercials editor in Australia. And I kind of interned with him. And yeah, just one thing led to another. And that was about 15 years ago.
Oh, wow. And so, yeah, so things kind of snowballed into, you know, regular editing jobs. And
yeah,
within you do a couple some assistant years. Editing first at all, or did you just get right into lead editing?
I was assisting while I was kind of interning for about 3 or 4 months, but it quickly turned into a pretty full-time editing gig. So that was good because I wasn't a very good assistant, to be honest. Not very good.
But you
at
knew
all.
You were going to be you knew your chops and your skill set was going to land you.
Yeah, I kind of took to it really quickly and really loved it. So, and I was really driven. Like I was doing like 90-hour weeks, kind of just trying to like get as much experience as possible and cutting short films and music videos and commercials all at the same time. And
then a couple of the avid? Oh, sorry.
All Avid, yeah. Well, I started, the first thing I started on was Final Cut, just for the first kind of month or two. And then the editor I was working with, he was on Avid. So I kind of had to learn Avid. And then, yeah, I just kind of stuck to Avid. I haven't really used anything since. I've kind of jumped on like a friend's documentary and stuff that was in Premiere, and it's like kind of, it's just like having one hand tied behind my back, like, you know, because I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know the program very well.
Yeah,
no dis on the program. I just don't know how to use it very well.
Yeah, no, so, it's people kind of have something that they learned with and that they like.
Yeah,
and that tends to be,
and the muscle memory that, you know, kind of lets you work without thinking too much about what you're actually, you know, the operation part of it. So, yeah, and then I kind of cut a short that did really well with Sam Holst, a great friend and a director, and that went to Cannes and it won I think it was a Crystal Bear at Berlin. And then the next year I cut my first feature, Hail, which was, you know, a really indie feature in Australia, low budget, with a great director doing his... He'd done a bunch of documentaries, one called Bastardy that was, like, amazing, and it was his first feature. And they didn't have a lot of money because it was a tiny indie, so they were kind of looking for someone kind of that they could afford, but who was also, right, you know, doing nice work. And that film did really well in Australia. It won, like, best film at the Actors, best Australian film at the Actors that year, I'm pretty sure. But it was kind of really well-regarded in Australia, and that led to working with Dave Michaud on the Rover a couple of years later, and then me and Dave have had a great relationship, and he's we kind of love, I love working with him. I hope he feels the same way. But we did three films together.
So tell me about how Power of the Dog came to you, or how did that project come across and come into your sphere?
Yeah, well, Dave and David Michaud and Jane Campion are quite good friends. I've known each other for a really long time. So that was, I was known as, you know, an editor in Australia to talk to, and Dave had said really lovely things about me. And it was just good timing that Jane was looking for an editor at the time. We met up to read the script and kind of had a nice 3-hour meeting and got along really well. And yeah, that was
so when you have a meeting like that with someone like her about a project like this, I don't know the names like Benedict Cumberbatch are already attached, but obviously it's the Thomas Savage book. It's going to be a significant work, even if it's on a smaller scale. I don't know what the context was of the conversation, but obviously it's a big opportunity, you know, and she's a great filmmaker and artist and has been for so long. How do you approach that 3-hour conversation? I mean, I know how long you said. How do you, like, pitch it? How do you handle it and be like, I want to get this? Or how do you, what do you talk about? What do you prepare? You know?
I've kind of done the same thing with David quite a few years earlier, because jumping from Hail to the Rover was, you know, a really huge step. From the small indie to, you know, a film with Rob Pattinson, Guy Pearce, and, you know, a much bigger budget, and and Dave had just come off the back of Animal Kingdom, so there was a lot of, you know, eyes on that one. So I kind of was not as daunted as I probably would have been had it been the first time. So a lot of it's just about, for me, just, you know, editing such a, it's, you know, just the proximity to another person is such a huge part of the job, being in the same room. So a lot of it's, there's a huge part of it, like, you know, just, do you have good chemistry? Can you sit for 3 hours and chat? Is that going to be a thing? So, you know, a huge part of those editing interviews are about personality, as long as you kind of get the script. And I know Jane's work pretty well, and I love those kind of films, so I kind of felt like taste-wise would be a really good match. So I wasn't too worried about that. It was just about, like, making a good impression was a huge part of it, really.
And sure you both saw the film the same, the story the same way. Did you talk about pacing and that sort of, it's such a deliberately paced movie.
Yeah.
Different than most these days.
Well, I think Jade had seen my work with Dave, and we've kind of done a lot of that. We kind of work in a slightly similar kind of tone, I guess.
Sure.
Like a lot of atmosphere and, you know, a slow burn and hopefully a lot of tension building. So I think Jane was pretty confident I could handle those elements. So we talked a lot about the feeling of the film and, you know, went through a lookbook, and there was some great reference to like early Montana kind of, you know, 1920s cowboys and what they would wear. And we talked a lot about tension and psychology in the film. Yeah, I guess I'm really confident in that realm. So I wasn't too worried about us not seeing, like the script was so good, and I just knew exactly what Jane was going to be going for. I could just feel what Jane was going for from the script and knowing her previous work. So
streamlining the post-production video editing process just got a whole lot easier with Spider Checker Video. It's a handy, portable tool designed to leverage how video is processed when working with vector scopes, waveform monitors, and editing software. Included is a patent-pending color pattern card that generates an easy-to-understand pattern of hues at 2 saturation levels, so you can see how all colors between primary and secondary colors are being captured. The result? You start off with more accurate color at the start of your video shoots, so you have less color editing to do later. Now you can save $20 off the purchase price of Datacolor Spider Checker Video. Just visit datacolor.com/NFS and enter code NFS at checkout. Offer is valid in US and Canada through 6/30/24.
That part I was.
How would you describe that? The thing that you knew she was going for, that reading it, you were like, how would you put, what would you, if you had to put your finger on that thing that you're talking about, that like quality that it has?
Well, a kind of really complex film about people and desire and psychology and you know, a certain amount of damage and pain, which Jane does really well, and a yearning and a repression. So it was kind of, you could feel it was going to be a really human film and really get deep into the psychology of people and people who can't be themselves and how that kind of manifests and how that has an effect on everyone else. I mean, yeah, so that was the most exciting thing about the script when I read it, was these really unique relationships between, you know, the brothers and then the boy and the rancher Phil, and then the, you know, the complicated relationship of, you know, George and Rose, which is kind of, you know, the most typical relationship, but one that, you know, George doesn't really know how to be a great husband. and in that in that time, that's, you know, probably quite typical.
There's a couple of things that I'm really fixated on. I feel like you mentioned a lot of the important relationships, but I feel like there's one relationship that looms large over the whole movie, and it's between Phil and Bronco Henry, who's an invisible man, but who is referenced constantly. Not just verbally, but like visually, like the cuts to things that say his name, his initials on the, like, did you have conversations about like, how often should we bring him up, and how do we make sure, like with that handkerchief, that people are 100% certain that this is his, and that this is his influence? That how did you talk about him?
It was interesting. We did a lot, actually. And we did actually trim not a couple of whole mentions out, but just his name out, just because it was like, okay, maybe there's like one or two too many here.
There were a few. You got to the point where you were like, I think he's talking about him too much.
And also with the scarf, you know, it's like with the BH, you only really see it for a moment, and then you see it in reverse on the other side. And we knew there'd be a significant amount of people who aren't watching that, you know.
Do you think people miss that? Because I was thinking afterwards, and I thought, I bet even if, like, for me as an audience, this is the kind of thing I know we're in the weeds here, but it's fascinating.
No, it's all good.
I think for an editor, it's probably one of the things these kinds of things you talk about. Because to me, I thought, I wonder if it hadn't had the BH, I think I would have deduced that it was his. Do you ever make those conversations where you're like, what can we let them figure out, and what do we need to tell them?
Absolutely. Because the BH was, it's subtle, you know, like I definitely know some people miss it because we did some test screenings, as you always do. And, you know, like most people got it, but maybe like 2 in 10 weren't concentrating on that or didn't put it together. But
did you ask that in like a questionnaire or something like that?
Not so much. It was more like a focus group and just a conversation after a screening.
Yeah, interesting.
Just kind of go through your questions. And that one came up a couple of times, but everyone knew that it was his or meant something significant in that relationship without having to see the BH anyway, because we'd done the work earlier, I guess. You know, that was his fixation. So it was, it wasn't necessary.
I wanted to ask you about early on when when he first comes up, there's a lot of pieces I was trying to put together in part one. It was like, are these guys ranchers? Do they own this place? Are they brothers? Why are they sleeping in the bed? Like, are they rich? Like, there's no, and I really loved how you guys pieced it for us, where you were like, and because he's like wants to toast to this guy who he keeps talking about, but who is Bronco Henry? Like, why is he talking about him all the time? And you didn't tell us for a very long time. Did you talk about pacing that way and like respecting audiences? Like, that's, I gotta say, like, these days you get spoon fed a lot as an audience.
I didn't feel like we had to talk about it just because that's Jane's thing, you know. Jane is that director, so it's like you're doing a Jane film, you know, it's going to be, well, not even challenging for an audience, but respect the audience to work it out and give you hopefully just the right amount of information that you're piecing it together as Jane wants you to piece it together as a story, you know, a telling of the story that's a little more interactive than, you know, a one-way street of just listening to it.
And that's, do you as an editor though, you and her are the ones, you're really on the front line in the trenches at the end making the call of like, I think if we, like, for example, another specific detail, there's the shot of the rope as he's weaving it, the shot of his hands in the water. And for me, like, I didn't put it together when I was like, wait, why is this so important? I know he's gonna kill, like, I was like thinking, no, spoiler alert, sorry, I was thinking, he's gonna kill this guy. But I didn't know that was how, because I hadn't pieced together the scene with the stripping and with the cow with anthrax. Like, these conversations are so important, and these the emotional beats that you're putting together, you know?
Totally, yeah. A lot of those were, we knew that you've got to kind of know that there's a scale of audience. Some will be like, they're incredibly, well, so people watch things slightly differently, you know. Some people are into every detail. Some people are getting taken along by the emotion. But we kind of had a feeling the biggest part of the audience, the biggest portion of the audience, would be hopefully really just fascinated and enthralled by Phil and Peter's relationship and the emotional, you know, this dangerous love story that was unfolding. And then hopefully we'd planted those shots and those clues strongly enough that when you got it, you could then run back through it and hopefully watch it again.
That's exactly. So what you're describing then, so you did it. It worked for me because that's what happened. I thought, oh, that piece has come together in my mind after. But when I watched it the first time through, I mean, obviously the Bronco Henry is a different story, but like I was thinking a lot about the dynamic between them. I wasn't thinking about where that rope came from.
Yeah. That's our focus. Right, yeah, for sure. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And there are like really nice, like little Mr. X, like he's cutting the cow, but he also, you know, dissects rabbits in his room because he wants to be a surgeon. So you're not necessarily thinking about the diseased cow at that moment. You're thinking Pete's out on a little field trip doing some science work.
It's so deliberate. Every choice is so deliberate to the end goal that it's like a nice little, you know, Swiss watch in that sense of editing.
Yeah. And also we really wanted that discussion. Well, I mean, we talked about hopefully, you know, if some people didn't get it, they asked the person next to them or called their friend or, you know, and had to talk about what was going on there. Did that actually happen that way? And also talk more about the deeper kind of themes of, you know, love and, you know, hopefully there's a sense of pain as well, like that Phil's gone, even though he's been
I think you did throughout. You achieved that too. He feels like you managed to create, you guys, you, Jane, everybody, Benedict Cumberbatch, a villain who is extremely sympathetic and pained And it's very hard to see him in simple terms by the end. He's a victim.
Yeah. Yes.
Kind of, that to me, that felt like the heart. I mean, and that's why I thought about Bronco, this Bronco Henry figure so often, because he's kind of the prime force behind that story.
Absolutely. Yeah. And getting to kind of illustrate what he meant to Phil through, you know, just through really tactile, tender scenes with objects, like a, you know, and some stories that he regales early in the film. But, you know, we really, it was a very visual telling of the backstory of Bronco Henry and Phil. You know, mm-hmm. there's no flashbacks or anything like that. So it's kind of all had to be, you know, and so much of that was on Benedict to do such an amazing job to, you know, illustrate that pain and that, and the sense of loss of this great love. I feel like Phil judges everyone else's love in a kind of way where it's like Rose and George, like that's not the real thing. It's like what me and Bronco had was the real thing. that was passion, you know. So it was kind of yes. like this really interesting.
Yeah, I never thought about right. that, but it's true. He does seem to look down his nose at anything that's not what he and Bronco Henry had. I also want to ask, when you're cutting, I can't imagine how many versions. I've talked to a lot of editors when there's an amazing performance happening, but when you get, you know, for example, the obvious one, he's exploding and he hits the horse, Phil, or mm-hmm. or he's really loses it about the, there's some really big, like, emotional scenes that he just brings it, you know? How many times do you have to look through, how many takes do you have to decide, and how do you and Jane, like, discuss, like, I mean, I'm sure Benedict Cumberbatch gives you a lot to work with, you know? He's a very talented performer.
Totally.
So.
We didn't have... actually, there was on the horse take. There was the on the horse scene. There were a lot of takes of, especially the really close up kind of emotional beat where it's, and it was more variations of like how much does he, because he's kind of calling Rose a, you know, a whore and stuff in that
yes.
moment when he's beating the horse. So we kind of really needed to make it clear that this is just him kind of, you know, essentially. Seeing Rose in front of him, not so much a horse. Right. So it was just varying degrees of that. I mean, he was so great there and so plugged in. It was pretty much, it's, you know, one of the funnest parts of my job is to just watch actors really go for it. And, you know.
Yeah, that's cool, actually. Do you get to see things they try and think, oh, interesting, like in this part, he really went in a different direction. We're not going to use it. But it's like you have... As you said, it's like the fun part of your job. I've never thought about it as an editor gets to see like every variation on the work, like different ways he talked about Bronco Henry, for example. Like
yeah,
you got
totally,
to see all the
totally.
Different versions.
You see the choices, and you also see Jane's direction, and you see, you know, the initial kind of, and you also just see, the evolution of a performance as well. So, I mean, that one was really interesting because it was just varying degrees of how explicitly about Rose it was. You know, it's like subtle to really clear. And we kind of, I think we landed somewhere in the middle. But yeah, there were a lot of takes on that one. And the blow up at the end, there was maybe 11 or 12. You know, nothing crazy. It's a lot of takes. It's a long scene, you know.
Yeah, and you have a lot of, puts you in a position where you really have to try to determine what works best, or you know, maybe one.
Yeah.
Like what goes into deciding or choosing among 10 takes of some of Benedict Cumberbatch like losing it in this explosive like, you know, act two, like you know, apotheosis of the movie. Like that's a huge take to choose. What do you got? What are the conversations like?
Well, a lot of it's like for Jane. With Jane and as much as you can, it's all about believability for Jane, like what's real, like what makes her feel something. So it's really about honing in on like the most organic feeling, the most powerful belief, like realist emotion that we could get. So, I mean, it's not so much, I mean, that's it for Jane. Like, you know, she just wants everything to be real.
Honesty. And,
honest. Totally.
Yeah.
So that's really what you're judging more than anything else. Because every performance, you know, it's Benedict Cumberbatch. It's great in every take.
He's fun to watch. It feels like he's someone you have to watch kind of no matter what he's doing, which adds so much to the character. He's absolutely. You gotta watch him.
And his really magnetic character, and him doing that was, really kind of, a pretty great thing to sit down every day, you know, and get new dailies and get to watch it first, which is pretty cool.
I don't want to go on forever, but I could. There's something else I want to mention or ask about. Is it's a Western, but it's kind of, you know, it's a 1925 Western, and it has like modern themes, and it's written in the 60s. And so there's a lot going on there, but how much did you and Jane and the rest of the team talk about the idea of how the Western and the cowboy mythos impacts America? I mean, you're Australian. Cowboys in Australia, you guys have your own thing kind of with that, right?
Yeah, and it's not a million miles off that kind of, there's a like famous Man from Snowy River story. I mean, there is an element, it's different, but there is that kind of, you know, emblematic, a kind of quintessential man, the real masculine kind of, you know,
so,
every culture has that, I guess, you know.
It's and
cowboys are the American kind of version.
Right.
But, yeah.
And it's such a, it's such a tortured, like troubled thing. It seems like a source of so many problems. And Phil just embodies that, especially the repressed part. Did you guys talk about that and just get a reflection of like, what is this hypermasculinity and its relationship to homosexuality or being like, there's a lot to unpack. I get, and Bronco Henry, really, not just his name, but like the way he's like, he's the greatest rider, he was the greatest camper, he was the greatest shooter. It just seems like he's the symbol of that. Did those conversations happen?
Yeah, I mean, they happen all the way through. There's no like big conversation. I guess those conversations happen in talking about Steens and Phil's character especially. And yeah, I mean, that was kind of part of the conversation through the whole job. So it's probably like, you know, it's like an 8-month conversation or a 12-month conversation.
So it was absolutely part of, you weren't, because sometimes I'll ask people about these kinds of things in movies, like subtext or the, and they'll say, we really just are looking at the story about these characters. And other times the answer is kind of what you're saying, which is interesting that it's like, oh yeah, we were always talking about it.
It's a combination of the two, but we definitely, I mean, the thing we talked about most for Phil was how much Bronco meant to him. What love was this, and how do we portray that? You know, but there is, you know, Phil is trying to be, well, presenting as that guy as well. So it's a really big part of the story that Phil is this kind of hyper masculine guy who shuts, well, basically tries to dominate everyone around him in that way that he's, you know, he's a better musician than Rose, and he's a better conversationalist than George, and you know, they kind of, you know, so he's kind of this really accomplished man, and that's his shield
for who he really is.
We talked a lot about how do we strip back the layers slowly, and how there were scenes that we moved that were far earlier, like the bathing naked in the river was used to come in at the end of the first act, the first chapter, and we kind of brought it further in to go with the saddle, so it was kind of a longer beat, but just one beat of that after Rose and George, after your extra Rose and George having sex for the first time in the room next door. So it was about making connections and just really modulating everything, so you know, you didn't have one thing like, you know, we just needed this really even flow through the building of Phil's character and the tension in the film. And I think all those things needed to work together for it to really come together and be that slowly ratcheting up and slowly stripping back and understanding more and more of this man.
You said something though there that really strikes a nerve for me, which is that editing is obviously placing like one thing after another in a timeline, but the choice of where you put something like him naked bathing, like what comes right after, changes the meaning when we watch the scene. Just like the old like Eisenstein tests and stuff like that. It's like
exactly,
the most basic fundamental thing. Like where you put that, where
are
you guys moving that later, totally changed what it meant, the context of it. Like if it had come a little earlier, I would have associated it with the scene before that. But instead, I actually associated it with the scene, like what he just experienced. That's amazing. It's just the magic of it.
Yeah, totally. That's the job. Exactly. And it did, you know, it really changed things dramatically. Also, after that scene, he used to go into that same cubby that Pete finds the magazines in and read the same magazine. So we were giving away a lot there.
Oh, wow.
And we just took that out completely because it was just too much too early in the story. And it felt very reductive of like, okay, this guy's like this because of this secret, you know. It was
If you had done all that early, but instead you dragged out the just talking about how great Bronco was, and then somebody else sees the name legend on the box with the magazines, like, which forces us to put more pieces together. I think it's great. It's very educational for people to learn that the way you piece things together that way, if you're intentional about every choice, it really has a big impact on what the meaning is.
Yeah. We spent one of the things with Jane is, you know, in our first meeting was like, she just needed someone, a big part of what she looks for in an editor is someone who's going to be as focused and dedicated as her and essentially never give up. And that's editing to me. It's like just persistence.
That's a great place for us to come, like kind of wrap up is like, how do you know when it's done? Like you could edit forever, right? You could keep tweaking and moving. Or like, how did you ever, with anybody you're collaborating with, but you with her in this instance, what were the signs that kind of led to, you know what, I think we have it as good as it's going to be? I mean, is it a deadline?
Yeah.
Or is it?
There's a little bit of deadline. We didn't actually have a really strict deadline. We had a little bit of leeway on this one, knowing when we were releasing and COVID threw the schedule out so much that it felt like it could go on forever at one point, but but you just kind of start to get the feeling that you're close, and then, you know, when you think you're close, you've probably still got quite a lot of work to do, but it's the work becomes really a lot finer, and you can feel that the blocks and the overalls now in a place where it just feels right, you know. It's just a feeling of like, this feels right.
So you just persisted, the two of you, until you got to that, like, I think we're, it felt the feeling.
Yeah, and then you get into the really fine work, which is like making every cut as good as it can be, and every, you know, every moment and every scene as tight as it can be, and just getting the exact right momentum to it, because you kind of hopefully find the structure before you kind of get to the point where you're fine cutting too much, like fine tuning too much. Otherwise, you're probably wasting a lot of time.
And then in all those, you know, those test screenings and stuff, once you feel like you've got it and you guys are fine tuning, are there things that come up where you say, we gotta change everything.
Luckily nothing where it was drastic, change everything. Yeah, it was more like a detail that was maybe being missed by the audience that we kind of went, oh, okay, we can clear that up, or we can just make that a little stronger, or spend a little bit more time.
Like the initials on the handkerchief? Or
No, that wasn't one. We were fine with them not seeing it. It was actually the one that came out of it was a mention of anthrax in the start of the film.
I remember that.
Yeah, there was a scene we'd cut out because it was just really too long for the first act, where Phil and the cowhands saw an anthrax cow out there before he rode up and chatted to George about, you know, the 25 years since their first ride and all that. So that had to go, but we just used a little bit of that dialogue on top of a wide shot placed the anthrax cow from that scene that we cut out in the background, and it looked like everyone's looking at it when he yells out about it. But we kind of managed to get the scene back without getting the scene back. So there's lots of that kind of work, you know. Like,
I love the insight. Yeah, cut out that's a detail, awesome.
And you find a way to bring that detail back without bringing all the baggage with it that
you lost the scene, but you needed to talk about anthrax. Otherwise, it comes out of left field. So you had to find a way to artificially bake it into that moment. Yeah.
Yeah. And hopefully you find the right artificial way where it feels organic.
Yeah. No, I mean, I would never have guessed, you know, with the dialogue laid over a wide shot, like no one would have known that it wasn't part of that scene.
Yeah. There's another example of that with Rose. When Rose first arrives at the ranch, there's a scene with Rose and Phil much later in the film where he calls Rose a cheap schemer. Mm-hmm. But in that initial scene, and we kind of lost that because it just didn't feel right. It just didn't sit in the story in the fourth chapter. It just kind of, we had enough of that relationship and Phil had done enough damage. It kind of felt like we'd totally delivered on that. But that line was really kind of felt really crucial, so that when Rose first got there, instead of Phil just saying, "I'm not your brother," and going back to his magazine, he kind of delivers a bit more of a hefty blow to start that relationship up. So we kind of took that line and brought it earlier. And then Benedict ended up doing ADR, but just for us to try it and bring that line.
So where did the line land if it was an ADR land? I don't remember. Or an ADR line.
So we built it as, I'm not your brother, you're a cheap schemer.
On a reverse or something?
Yeah, on a reverse.
Okay, cool.
Reverse. Yeah. So yeah, there's lots, you know, it's filmmaking. It's like, you know,
yeah, but that's the important details, like making that decision that, again, that line sticks in your mind, calling her a cheap schemer.
You're well, like, oh, yeah, wow. And it's something he used to say to her and didn't anymore. And it was right. Like, oh, that's a great detail. Like, that's a detail we need to really just kind of, yeah, give us a little bit more of an indication where, well, it puts Rose, you know, Rose is dealing with a lot and her, she's not from the class they're from. They're really rich mm-hmm. ranchers. She's mm-hmm. kind of working class. So, you know, the fact that he kind of says that she's there just for their money instantly tells her that, like, okay, she's not being welcomed here beyond.
Yeah, I think it's such an obvious attack that it puts her on her heels, and it informs the whole sequence with the piano, because it's like, if it had just been, well, I don't really like you very much, I don't think it would have been like, okay, so he doesn't like her. He doesn't seem to like anybody except Bronco Henry. But if it had been, when you add in that like land of like, and I'm watching you because you're a fraud, you're up to something.
Exactly.
Changes everything. Like, it's absolutely necessary. Yeah.
Yeah. So those kind of little moments that all happened in the last, you know, 3 weeks of the edit. Like, so you just kind of go, okay, I'm missing a detail at that stage that maybe we're filling in or we think is there that isn't. So that's the really helpful bit of getting eyes on it towards the end, just going, oh, okay, we can make that better. Like, it's working, but we can make it stronger through conversations with, and just understanding how the audience is watching it exactly. So that fine tuning, that calibration, kind of, that's the last phase. And when you feel like you've done all of that, then you feel like you're ready.
Well, I'm really grateful to you for giving the specific answers and the details, because I think it's kind of like, I know it's an overused phrase, but like a masterclass on just this, what goes into being intentional with edits. It does completely change your story, and that's what editing is supposed to be. So I think it's been great talking to you about it, and the movie obviously is being enjoyed and talked about and written about, and I'm very excited for where it's going to go for you guys.
Thank you. Yeah, awesome. Yeah, it's been fun so far. So yeah, it's been a bit of a wild ride for an Australian editor from the other side.
Yeah,
of the
world. I mean, it's a big this movie has got, like, when we started talking about doing this interview a while ago, I was very excited to see it. I love westerns. I had no idea what it was. Now we're doing it, it's like, this is the one people are talking about a lot. So it's great.
Yeah, let's go. That's cool.
All right. Well, yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Peter, for coming on the podcast. We're very lucky to get guests like Peter and to be able to talk about editing the movies that are the talk of the year. It's really special. And I'm glad we can bring to all of you the insights. If you ever have things you wished we talked about or that I asked, please let us know. That, as well as any questions you can ask on our weekly show, which releases every Thursday, where these interviews will always come out on a Tuesday. But either way, just email us at editor@nofilmschool.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, check us out on Instagram and YouTube, and definitely tune in on the website www.nofilmschool.com for all kinds of interesting things that we are always doing.